The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Welcome to Disrespect's fundraiser show. Once a year, we try to raise our portion of the $200,000 a year it costs to run CFMU, a sum I'm reminded that commercial stations can pay for just promotions alone. We approached Metro, both Dan Thomas at the Metro Governors Road and Mike Lavelle at the Metro Osler Drive in University Plaza contributed to CFMU this year, Lucy Kaluri at Fortino's Main West, and Sam Marchese at Fortino's Dundurn also contributed to food and refreshments for our volunteers here. As always, Vortman's contributed and Denninger's contributed sausages for us as well. Lots of thanks to those people who contribute to our fundraiser and help to make it a success. Perhaps you'd like to contribute to CFMU as well. Call 528-9888 and make a pledge anytime there's a host at the station, and that's all the time during fundraising week. Or go to the website, cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Disrespect introduces Al Mussel. He's a senior associate at the George Morris Center and president.
Canadian Agricultural Economics Society.
Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Jeff.
We were talking about ethanol and its effect on food, and I had a question. Is ethanol a large effect on food or simply an unknown and growing effect on the price of food?
Well, you know, it's probably more so the latter. There's a lot of things that affect the price of food. Bad weather in other parts of the world, growing demand in places like Southeast Asia, changes in productivity and in producing farm products related to research investment, that sort of thing,
okay.
As well as new demands for corn and grains as feedstocks,
right.
such as ethanol. So ethanol is an important factor. It's not the only factor by any stretch of the imagination.
Right. But it's not bringing the price of food down.
No. I mean, anytime you introduce a new demand for a farm product, it has the effect of increasing the price of it.
Okay.
And yeah, that filters through to the price of food.
Yeah.
You know, we've concentrated on cattle and hogs. Is the effect limited to cattle and hogs?
Yeah.
And the answer to the question is no. I mean, the first level effect is really on all users of corn and feed grains. So in our work, we've focused on cattle and hogs because it's very much of a margin business, heavily dependent upon relative costs of corn and feed grains. But it really affects all users of corn and feed grains. So the dairy industry, the poultry industry, they're in a little bit of a better position to handle this because they've got regulated authority, supply managed marketing system that allows them to pass this on through. The other group that it affects, of course, is going to be your corn wet millers, the people who make corn sweeteners, corn-based foods, corn flours, et cetera, as well as industries that that make fibrous products from starch and grains, like you know, you've got car door panels.
Oh, really?
Made from corn.
No idea.
Foam cups, diapers, things like this.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, I mean, basically anybody who's an end user that doesn't have the benefit of subsidy that ethanol plants do bears the brunt of this.
Yeah, so sweeteners, fibers, as well as any food made from animal products.
Sure, I mean the other one would be your distilling industry, sure.
Yeah, people forget that rye is a large portion corn now.
Yeah, that's correct, yes.
Yeah, okay. So was I correct that the U.S. is legislated more ethanol content in gasoline than Canada?
Yes, that's correct. The United States has a 10% blend mandate of ethanol and gasoline for motor vehicles.
Right.
In Canada, we're nationally at 5. Now, we also have provincial mandates, most of which are pretty consistent with the 5%.
Okay.
Saskatchewan, I believe, is 7.
Oh.
And there may be another province that's different than 5 that I can't think of offhand. But but for the most part, it's pretty consistent with 5% blend mandate.
Okay. Now, this is already such a force that it's people are moving production from feedstocks into corn for ethanol, right?
Yes, that's correct. So if you look at the corn crop today in the United States, about 40% of the utilization is in ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
And just dealing with Ontario as the major corn-producing region in Canada, but 30% of the corn is being used in ethanol.
Okay.
There is some utilization of wheat in Western Canada to make ethanol, but it's much smaller, much earlier stage of development.
Oh, okay. We can expect more wheat, more use of wheat, and no decline in the use of corn.
Yes, I think that's a fair assessment.
And economically, what effect is this having on the price of the different foods?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the U.S. is such a large player in the corn market, and they have such a large domestic economy, that when you introduce a new demand for corn, as we have in the last 10 years, and in particular the last 3 or 4 years, as the mandate increased to 10%,
right.
The effect of that it increases global corn prices, just because the U.S. is such a large player.
Oh, okay.
So that U.S. policy effect has increased global corn prices, and the other feed grains tend to follow behind corn. Canada is a very small player, both in terms of a corn producer and the size of our ethanol market. So when we introduce an ethanol mandate of 5%, what it does is it really only affects the Canadian market. It doesn't really, it's not significant enough to influence the global market.
Right.
The difficulty of this is that means that the effects of Canadian ethanol policy are essentially concentrated in the Canadian market.
Okay.
And that's a bit troublesome for us because a number of our industries, notably red meat production, which is leveraged on an export footing, in other words, we produce far more than we consume.
Right.
The economic logic for that is that most of the year we have a little bit of a cost advantage over the United States in terms of feeding the animals.
And how is that?
Just historically we've had more than we can use through most of the year.
Okay.
So we've been at a little bit of a price discount.
Right.
And that little bit of a price discount has been kind of the economic logic for having the livestock production here to supply meat plants, which then export and so forth.
All right.
With Canadian ethanol policy, what it does is, as I say, it's focused, because we're such a small player, its focus is in Canada. But what it does is it takes that small cost advantage that existed for most of the year and, you know, whittles it the way to make it a cost disadvantage
in the local market.
And then you start looking at, you know, meat production on the scale that we've had, livestock production, and you start to say, well, you know, look, the cost rationale for having that activity located in Canada just it isn't there anymore.
Oh.
And that's what the challenge is with Canadian.
So how does that work, that mechanism?
Ethanol policy.
How does that mechanism work that we turn an advantage into a disadvantage?
How does that mechanism work? Well,
yeah.
You know, it's in a way it's fairly simple. You know, most of the year, just deal with Ontario for most of the year. We are on what we refer to as an export basis for corn. In other words, we have more corn available than we have uses for.
Right.
So some of that corn has to move outside the country in order to find a marketplace.
Yeah.
And there's a freight cost associated with that. So
right.
if you look at kind of a Chicago price as being sort of the benchmark of a global price, you'll find that the prices that our farmers receive are just a little bit lower than that Chicago price through
right.
most of the year.
Right.
That essentially covers the freight to allow the market to clear.
Okay.
Now there is, you know, some people will point out that in the summertime it's a different situation, and that's right. Seasonally, we end up being short in the summertime until we get the new harvest, and that's been the case for, you know, I've only seen 40 years worth of data. It's probably gone on longer than that, but
okay.
But that's always the case. But the point is that most of the year we're at this small cost disadvantage, and that's enabled us to leverage a livestock and meat production industry at the scale that we have.
All right. But it turns into a disadvantage, you say?
Well, it turns into a disadvantage just because when you introduce a new demand in the marketplace that didn't exist previously.
Right.
And particularly when that demand is subsidized.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, you can't have new facilities that demand corn the way that ethanol plants do without, you know, essentially eating up that surplus
right.
that would have been exported to the United States through part of the year. I mean, that has an immediate price effect.
In Canada.
So what we're going to see longer term is, you won't see that same export basis.
Right.
What you will see, rather, is you'll tend to see relatively more imports of corn into Canada.
Okay.
And through the year, you would expect that that you won't see the kind of price discount that we've had.
Oh, okay. So the price of meat, for one thing, is going up and not coming down.
Well, you know, the long-term implication of this is for a higher price of meat. Now,
right.
I mean, what we focused on a little bit in our research is not so much that effect as the effect that, you know, just the logic for having meat processing and livestock production located in Canada starts to erode away.
Right, because it's more expensive.
So we haven't dealt so much with the world price of meat going up as we have with the fact that the rationale to produce it here is being, as I say, eroded away. True, I mean, over the long haul, if you increase the price of the feed grain, just as that passes down the chain and makes it more expensive for the farmers to feed the livestock, so they start to cut back, then there's less livestock to process in meat plants, and all other things being equal, the price will go up, yes.
Okay. Take a break with me with Steel Rail, a thought on abandoned farms. Old Forgotten Road.
One time my grandpa told me something Russell Barton told him about when Russell's mother was a girl. She worked up on the Lily Farm above the old abandoned snow road that used to run across the grindstone hill. He talked about the olden days and how one time farming family had worked the land and built themselves a home. They lived up there for many years and how it came to be deserted. Nobody remembers anymore. And they would rise up in the mornings, coax the fire from the coals. They live their lives and dream their dreams, just the same as you and me. In the hard times of 100 years ago, now it all lies down that old forgotten road. Stone found it. plantation still lies upon that hillside. Trees have grown from the old dirt cellar floor. All signs of where the road once ran are lost among the hardwoods that cover every foot of that old farm. And on a hot and lazy summer day, we roamed around that side hill, an old man and a young boy in the woods. Told me where you're standing now was a wagon road to Plevna, and this is where the Lily farmhouse stood. Where they would rise up in the mornings, coax the fire from the coals. They live their lives and dream their dreams just the same as you and me. In the hard times of 100 years ago, down that old forgotten road, where they would rise up in the mornings, coax the fire from the coals. They lived their lives and dreamed their dreams just the same as you and me. In the hard times of 100 years ago, now it all lies down that old forgotten road.
Before we go back to our interview, each year we receive pledges from all over the country and all over the world. I'll have to tell you, I don't normally toot my own horn, but a civil servant listens to the show weekly, likes the snarky asides, and says they come like from inside of his head because he's a civil servant and can't say these things. Academics at University of Manitoba as well as McMaster University listen to the show as well. And today, somebody walked up to me and said, "Can I get your show on the internet? I'm moving to Winnipeg, and I would like to get it there." If you like my show, why don't you contribute to it? Go on the web at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, on PayPal, and click the link to contribute to the show. Or you can call the station and make a pledge, 528-9888. Don't delay, because the interview is going to start again. This affects other things that come from livestock farming or farming of any kind of animals that depend on grain, right?
So if I understand your question, are there a range of effects of having a structurally higher price for feed grains? Well, yes, there is. I mean, the first thing is that corn and feed grains compete for a land base with other crops.
Right.
So as corn prices go up, ignoring any of the many other factors that are in play at a given point in time, just the sheer increases in the price of corn and feed grains will drive the other ones up as well because they compete for a land base.
Okay.
People have the so-called indirect land use change that's referred to, particularly in the United States, around ethanol policy. As corn prices go up, corn begins to substitute for other crops.
Right.
There are concerns that there may be environmental considerations around that indirect land use change.
Such as?
For example, instead of the farmers rotating 1 year of corn with 1 year of soybeans, then 1 year of wheat.
Right.
You might have 2 years of corn, then a year of soybeans, then a year of wheat.
Yeah.
And the idea being that corn being a row crop, it has some soil erosion characteristics and so on that soybeans and wheat do not.
All right.
So that there could be some negatives with that. I mean, corn's a very high energy crop to grow.
Yeah.
So there's some energy consumption effects and so on.
Okay.
That's not something that we've particularly gotten into, but it's, from the environmental scientist perspective, it's something that they pay a lot of attention to.
Yeah, well, that, too, could drive up the cost of food, couldn't it? If it drives down the productivity of land.
Sorry, you say it again, John?
If it drives down the productivity of land, it could drive up the cost of food, too.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So it looks like, as you say, there are broad effects of this increasing demand for ethanol. And so in the end, there is a rising price of food almost across the board when you talk about the competition for land, too. I mean, this affects even the price of produce.
Yes, it does. I mean, we don't know how material it is, but, you know, there's some horticultural crops that the farmers will look at it and they'll say, well, look, if the price of corn and some of the field crops that I can rotate against corn have gone up structurally, then, you know, I have less incentive perhaps to produce horticultural crops, which tend to be a lot more difficult and labor-intensive and so forth to work with.
And when you say horticultural crops, what are they for the layman?
Well, so fruits and vegetables in general, but, you know, you think about processing vegetable crops, so tomatoes, carrots, beans, peas, things like that.
Where does this affect end?
Well, just, I mean, the farmer will look at this.
Yes.
And they'll say, well, okay, I can produce, for example, in extreme southern Ontario where we have a processing tomato industry. Some of the farmers will look at this and they'll say, well, okay, processing tomatoes are a very demanding crop to grow from the standpoint of management, labor, a lot of risk. They're expensive to grow.
Really?
You know, shucks, if corn has gone much higher in price, maybe I'd rather grow corn, which is, compared with processing tomatoes, probably easier to grow.
All right.
Less risky.
Yeah.
Less intensive in terms of operating inputs and so forth.
Okay.
You know, maybe I'll just do that instead.
Yeah.
Now, of course, over time, processing tomato prices have to adjust to that reality, but there does tend to be a little bit of a lag.
Okay. So
in that lag, you worry about losses in acreage of some horticultural crops.
So volatility of prices is what is the result.
Sorry, say it again?
Volatility of prices is the result?
Not so much the volatility in price, just the level of the price.
Yeah, but when you speak of a lag, it implies volatility, too. It implies a price that doesn't catch up,
and then it does catch up. But, you know, I mean, the way it works is like this.
Okay.
In Ontario, and Ontario is the part of Canada that has really the processing tomato acreage. It's a negotiated price on behalf of, we have a marketing board that negotiates on behalf of the farmers with processors.
All right.
And one of the factors that will go into that discussion is, you know, recent corn prices.
Okay.
Well, that negotiation is done in the spring of the year before the tomato crop is established.
All right.
In the intervening period, the price of corn could go way up.
Yeah.
And some of the farmers may decide, corn looks a little bit better than tomatoes.
Yeah,
maybe I'll grow corn.
Right,
and it's always when I say lags, it's just always that it's the process inherently. It's kind of one step behind information, and not that it could be otherwise. But
that's
just the nature of it.
Okay, so where does this process stop when we curtail our gasoline use?
Where does the process stop? Well,
driving up the price of all foods.
Right. Well, first of all, you're going to have increasing demands until you reach the point of meeting your mandate.
Yeah.
And from that point, you probably get kind of marginal changes according to the profitability in ethanol plants after the subsidies expire.
Oh, okay.
So we've got authorization for subsidies. I think they come up for review in 2017 or something like that.
All right.
After that, then, you know, you would expect there would be some mitigation in demand, potentially, if ethanol plants, and I guess just using the U.S. as an example, you know, you can go and find out what recent profitability status has been of ethanol production in the United States, and, you know, there'll be weeks where they're profitable, weeks where they run a little bit in the red.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And
this is with subsidy.
Eventually, that mitigates maybe I should restate it this way. I mean, the demand doesn't grow to infinity.
Right.
It grows to meet a blend mandate, and then after that, you get some fluctuations in demand consistent with the profitability of the ethanol plants.
Okay. Okay. So the profitability of the ethanol plants is the determinant of the demand, ultimately. And so the...
Absent subsidy, correct.
Yeah.
And that's going to be related to the price of gasoline and or crude oil.
Okay.
To a certain extent, the price of natural gas.
Okay.
And then, of course, the corn.
Yeah.
But the corn, I mean, the corn ends up being a little bit of a residual demand in the sense that ethanol plants have a real material effect in terms of the establishment of local prices for corn.
Meaning what? What is the residual effect?
A little bit of residual demand in the sense that, you know, if I'm looking high level at the way an ethanol industry works, it's going to be, well, okay, what's the revenue that I can sell my ethanol for? And that's largely determined by unleaded gasoline markets.
Right.
You know, what's the natural gas going to cost me
yeah.
for heating purposes in the plant? And then that margin that's left over tells me sort of the parameters within which I can bid for corn.
Okay. Okay.
You know, so I guess another way to say it is, you know, do ethanol plants influence the price of crude oil and or gasoline?
Yeah.
In the immediate term, not very much.
Right.
Do they influence the price of natural gas? Not very much.
Right.
Can they influence the price of corn? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And as we've discussed, they influence indirectly the price of almost all food production domestically.
Indirectly, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And this is abated when the subsidies end, and probably further when gasoline consumption, if and when gasoline consumption levels off.
Yeah, and then, you know, I guess I should, you know, subsidies come up for review.
Right.
They, you know, that doesn't mean they're going to be canceled.
No.
You know, we have had some policy change in the U.S. in this regard, so... We've recently had a decision, which I believe becomes effective in July of this year, to the effect that the tax credit for ethanol in the U.S. has been eliminated as a tariff protection.
Okay.
For ethanol.
All right.
But just to give you a sense, one of the Bruce Babcock, one of my academic colleagues, who's an expert in the U.S. on this topic. He says that ethanol plants going forward in the future will be able to bid $5 to $6 a bushel for corn, regardless of any tax credit or tariff protection.
Okay.
A little bit of an infant industry argument in the sense that they were protected for a sufficiently long period of time that you know, a lot of the capital is in place now.
Okay.
So that they're going to be able to go forward and do this. I suspect that we're not there in Canada.
All right. But as a neighbor of the U.S., how much are we under the influence of their economics regarding ethanol and gasoline and food?
Sorry, can you say that again?
As a neighbor of the U.S., how much are we under the influence of their economics in these commodities?
Well, we can have perhaps still are importing ethanol from the United States.
Okay.
We've also exported ethanol to the United States.
Okay.
So, yeah, we don't operate in isolation of their environment. That's right.
Absolutely. Okay. What did you want to say to sum up the picture of food prices and ethanol demand in Canada?
I guess I'd sum it up this way. The challenge that we have with ethanol policy in Canada is that any time that you introduce a new demand...
Right.
For a product as fundamental as corn, that has so many uses throughout the food system and even in non-food uses, this has reverberations. And you know, to date, most of the dialogue has been, you know, wow, we have a Canadian ethanol policy that will increase the prices that the farmers get for their corn,
okay,
and perhaps their feed greens in Western Canada. But there's never been. There's never been sort of the second level of question, which is, well, okay, and what effect does that have?
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been working for probably 4 or 5 years at least in research projects here at the center to try and explore that question. So, so what are the ramifications of that? And we think the ramifications of that are quite quite significant.
Wow. Okay. So you're continuing to work on this, and we'll continue to hear about it from your the George Morris Center and you and your colleagues. Okay, good. And is there a website where we can track this?
Yeah, so our website is www.georgemorris.org.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you can find a portfolio of research papers and projects that we've worked on in the past that relate to ethanol policy in Canada.
Hmm. Okay. Well, thank you, Al. I appreciate your time to talk about this.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jeff.
All right. Bye for now.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to Al Mussel. He's a senior associate at the George Morris Center and president of the Canadian Agricultural Economics Society on the relationship between ethanol and food prices to come. Bill Frisell, that's All Right, Mama. Now back to our fundraiser. We have some incentives for you. For $20, a pair of tickets for each show at This Ain't Hollywood. There are 1, 2, 3 shows left. A pair of tickets for $20 for shows at the Casbah. 1, 2 shows left. Friends of CFMU card gets you a discount at favored businesses throughout the city for a $30 donation. And for $50, Raise Your Voice t-shirt and a Friends of CFMU card. So crack that credit card or checkbook. CFMU.McMaster.ca or 528-9888. Call in and pledge. Disrespect introduces Sean Casey. He's the Member of Parliament for Charlottetown, the Liberal critic for Veterans Affairs, and the sole Liberal member on the Committee for Veterans Affairs. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here. First of all, what's happening is the government has announced through their planning and priorities report that was issued back last spring and then is confirmed in the estimates that the budget for Veterans Affairs Canada will, over the next 2 years, decrease by $226 million.
In October, you managed to suspend the process of bringing in the cuts. I'm very curious how that happened and how we got to this point with your intervention.
Yeah, okay. This was really very shortly after the Veterans Affairs Committee was struck in this parliament. And at the initial meetings, first of all, the makeup of the committee is seven conservatives, four NDP, and one liberal.
Yeah.
And so from the outset, the committee decides what work are we going to undertake first, what are our priorities. And I urged upon them that our priority must be the impact of the cuts on veterans and those who serve them.
Yeah.
That fell on deaf ears with the conservative majority.
Really?
They felt that the first thing that we should be examining is commemoration in the 21st century. So over my objections, we embarked on a study on commemoration. We were two or three or four weeks into that study and hearing from witnesses two mornings a week with regards to commemoration when there was a story air with respect to the $226 million.
Okay.
So I gave 48 hours notice of motion that I was going to present a motion to the committee to direct that the study on commemoration be suspended in favor of a study on the impact of the cuts. Now, from the outset, we didn't know. I mean, when I initially pitched the idea of looking at cuts, we didn't know specifics, but there was a report come out kind of in the middle of our work that gave some specifics. There's still more details to come. So I pitched that. I put that motion, gave notice of that motion. On the 48 hours later, we had our meeting. I arrived at the meeting and I saw that someone had set the agenda and had determined that my motion would be heard at the end of the meeting and in camera. So before the meeting started, the chairman pointed that out to me. I told him that it was unacceptable to me that my motion was going to be heard at the end of the meeting and in camera. I wanted it to be done at the beginning of the meeting and in public.
Right.
So we agreed to disagree on that. There were witnesses in the room at the time. The meeting started at 8:45 in the morning. At 8:45 in the morning, he gaveled the meeting to commence because we had a quorum. At that time, there were three conservatives in the room, plus the chairman, the four New Democrats, and myself.
All right.
So he gaveled the meeting, and as he was about to introduce the witnesses, I got his attention and immediately presented the motion in French. The conservative members of the committee who were present, three of the six were present, were fumbling for their simultaneous translation devices as I was presenting the motion. After I presented it, the chairman looked at me and said, as we discussed, Mr. Casey, I really wish that you would have done that where it is slated on the agenda.
Right.
However, it is properly before the meeting, and we have witnesses waiting, and I don't see anyone here waiting to speak to the motion, so let's go straight to a vote.
Really?
Yep. And we went straight to the vote. The four NDP voted with me, and the motion passed by a mark of 5-3. Then the other three conservatives entered the room, and there was confusion, there was angst, there was huddling, there was all kinds of stuff. And as a result of the motion passing, the witnesses were excused because the work into the commemoration study was suspended by virtue of the motion. I did get a chance to question the Minister of Veterans Affairs. My motion passed in the morning, and that afternoon in question period, I was able to get up and advise the minister of the small victory that had been scored for veterans that day, and then to invite him to come to the committee to testify with respect to the cuts and ask that he please come on time. Anyway, we didn't get a chance to hear from the minister on that.
Okay.
Because the study was terminated after hearing from the two departmental officials.
Doesn't leave a very positive impression about the effects of the cuts, does it?
Well, they don't want to talk about them.
Yeah.
Right. Plain and simple. They don't want to talk about them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So that's what happened. On top of that, there are at least two other things going on within Veterans Affairs.
Okay.
One is the Strategic and Operating Review, and that's going on in all government departments, and every department has been directed to provide a 5% plan and a 10% plan, meaning cut to overall expenditures in that amount.
Okay.
So that plan has been submitted by Veterans Affairs. They're waiting now to hear back from Treasury Board as to how deep the cuts will be under that rubric. Separate and apart from that, the Department of Veterans Affairs is going through something they call the Transformation Agenda.
I see.
And the Transformation Agenda arises out of a private consultant's report that was done a couple of years ago. His name is Keith Coulter. Mm-hmm. And they say that this is designed to streamline processes, to recognize the reality that the modern-day veteran has different needs than the traditional veteran, to mechanize processes within the department, to put more emphasis on frontline services, all of these sorts of buzzwords.
Right.
So these are the things that are going on within Veterans Affairs. Now, back specifically to the issue of the budget cuts and whether they will affect veterans' benefits, I have been pressing them on this point,
right.
Pressing them on the fact that they have already announced $226 million reduction over the next 2 years to the Veterans Affairs Canada budget. And the line that you get as soon as you ask about budget cuts in Veterans Affairs is veterans benefits will be maintained.
Right.
So that is the Conservative Party line, and it doesn't matter what the question is, that's the answer.
Yeah, okay.
If the question is, where could we reinvest the $226 million that you are cutting? The answer is, veterans benefits will be maintained.
Okay.
If the question is, where are the job losses going to come from, and how will that affect waiting times for veterans?
Right.
The answer is, veterans benefits will be maintained.
I see.
So it doesn't matter what the question is. That's the answer.
All right.
So it's been extremely, extremely frustrating. And that answer has been parroted by the minister, by the parliamentary secretary, by the deputy minister, and by the assistant deputy minister responsible for service delivery. Because all of them have been in the committee room, and all of them have said that with the change of a maximum of two or three words. That is so, the talking point.
Yeah.
And as I said, it doesn't matter what the question is. So the real difficulty that I have on all of this is the Veterans Ombudsman isn't buying it. Veterans advocacy groups aren't buying it. The Royal Canadian Legion isn't buying it. And quite frankly, I don't buy it. But when you try to probe deeper, you keep getting the same answer. And, I mean, we really should take a page out of President Obama's book and a page out of David Cameron's book in Great Britain and exempt the Veterans Department from the ongoing budget balancing exercise. The budget shouldn't be balanced on the backs of those who risk their lives for our country.
Right. That wouldn't be the same as exempting defense, though, would it? That would exempt
it
the veterans.
Be the same.
Yeah.
No. Veterans, the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of National Defense are two separate departments.
Okay.
There is a lot of cooperation as between them. There
right.
are Veterans Affairs employees who actually work on basis, you know, on D&D basis. But
right.
they're separate departments, separately administered. You know, a lot of naturally people graduate from one to the next in terms of the client base.
All right.
But it wouldn't be the same at all.
Pointed question, with the refusal to mold an answer in response to each question that is asked, do you get the impression that maybe fighting men are only valued by the Conservatives when they're fighting? Is that a little
harsh?
You
know what, I think that would be unfair.
Yeah.
As much as I disagree with the way they've dodged each of my questions,
yeah.
I don't question for one second that politicians on all sides of the House, want to do everything they can for veterans and absolutely respect what veterans have done. The difficulty that I have is that it's pretty clear that balancing the books is more important to the conservatives than doing everything they can. So I think their heart's in the right place, their priority isn't.
Okay. Interesting. Are there any other mandate is quite specific, but are there any other groups that you see that rank up there with balancing the budget, or is it like is it a numbers game in their view? Just a numbers game.
It's absolutely a numbers game for them, and they have taken the clear position that nothing is sacred.
Okay.
We debate this every day in the House as to whether the government should be doing more on climate change, whether the government should stop attacking the CBC, whether the government should show more support for our veterans, whether they should be plowing money back into infrastructure.
Right.
And I mean, these are the big issues. These are the pressures in the country, and clearly the government has taken the view that we're in a financially vulnerable situation with how we've overspent in recent years, and we have to get that back on track, and everything's on the table. That's the view that they've taken.
So it doesn't seem like that the government's been misleading about the financial situation for Canadians, but it seems like you say, they're taking a very broad brush approach to a solution, maybe hoping that no one particular constituency will be hard hit. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a wait and see. I think that the details will become much clearer when the next budget is announced, because, as I indicated, all departments are going through the strategic operating review right now. They've also been which departments receive a light touch and which ones are cut to the bone, because I do think that the disparity between how each department is treated will be dramatic. I don't think it'll be a uniform cut by any stretch.
Okay.
My hope is that Veterans Affairs receives a light touch or none at all.
Yeah.
But that's only one element of what's going on at Veterans. I'm very, very concerned about their transformation agenda and their so-called streamlining. Because right now, as an example, right now, a veteran who applies for disability benefits, the processing time is 16 weeks from the time they receive all the documentation from him.
Right.
The processing time for an EI claim is 4. So veterans have to wait 4 times as long based on their published standards. And lots of veterans and lots of unemployed people will tell you that they don't put much stock in those standards either. But, you know, when you have a service level there, and your commitment is to maintain it,
mm-hmm.
at the same time that you're cutting $226 million out of the budget, mm-hmm. there's something wrong.
Yeah. So you think they're either fooling themselves or they're fooling us?
Well, I think that if they profess to love the veterans, they profess to want to do the most they can for the veterans, but they're talking the talk and not walking the walk. because if they meant it, if they meant it, that $226 million would be plowed back in. They would have followed Obama's lead and said the Veterans Affairs Department will be exempt from cuts. And our commitment is to increasing the suite of benefits and reducing the wait times. And we'll do that by allocating the proper resources. So there's some lip service being paid.
Veterans advocates are still calling for, you know, statements, quantified information.
Within the veterans community, there are different advocacy groups calling for different things. Probably the best known advocacy group for veterans is the Royal Canadian Legion, and they are on record as asking the government of Canada to exempt the Department of Veterans Affairs from the budget balancing exercise. They have issued a letter and a press release to that effect. But there are other veterans advocacy groups, some of whom are calling for a Royal Commission of Inquiry, some of whom are asking that all veterans be treated the same in that World War II, what they call the traditional veterans are treated differently than the modern day veterans under the new Veterans Charter.
Right.
There's a whole host of various issues that are being advanced by various groups, but suffice it to say that all of the groups would be unanimous that cuts to the Veterans Affairs Department are a bad thing.
Yeah.
And that service could and should be improved with the money that has been cut.
Yeah, Sean Brouillet was quite vocal at the time that the Veterans Ombudsman position was up for grabs. Did he have anything to say about this?
I haven't spoken directly with him, but he is one of the best-known advocates for veterans. Did hear from him when we recently heard that two more veterans have had their privacy breached in terms of their medical records being accessed by communications people within the minister's office, and Mr. Brouillet was out on that.
And this is in Ontario, I take it?
No, Dennis Manouge was one of the people who had his medical file accessed by political staff. Dennis is from Nova Scotia.
Okay.
And the other fellow was Sylvain Chartrand. And I believe Sylvain is Quebec, but I could be wrong on that.
It's odd then. It's either the provincial health ministries are cooperating or their records are not secure.
There's no allegation that there's been cooperation from the provincial health ministers. Basically, Mr. Chartrand and Mr. Manouge have been outspoken advocates for veterans. Mr. Manouge is actually the lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against the Department of Veterans Affairs with respect to the clawback of benefits.
Oh, good.
From the insurance the insurance company for Veterans Affairs. So, both of them have been out in the public advocating in favor of veterans, and both of them have had their files, which were within Veterans Affairs for the purpose of adjudicating their claims for benefits. Both of them have had them accessed by political staff within the minister's office.
Oh, I see. Well, unfortunately, from my point of view, that doesn't bode well for any staff reorganization at Veterans Affairs either. If that's what the government wants, that's what the government will implement.
I'm not sure I follow that.
Well, if they're already getting access to these files and using them improperly, any new staff that they put in place or any rearrangement or promotion that they implement is going to favor that agenda.
You would hope not.
Yeah, you would hope not.
The Privacy Commissioner has conducted an investigation, and as a result of that, the Department of Veterans Affairs has what they describe as a 10-point action plan, all of which was put in place after the transgressions complained of. I guess I'll be interested to see when the Privacy Commissioner comes back to see whether they've cleaned up their act.
Yeah. As far as Sean Brouillet went, he is an Ontarian, and I'm not sure he's aware of the import of the Accessibilities for Ontarians with Disabilities Act for what the federal government's done.
Well, Mr. Brouillet, is my understanding that he did negotiate a settlement in connection with the privacy breach against him. I'm not aware of the particulars of the settlement, but it's my understanding that there was a negotiated settlement. There's been no such negotiated settlement with the latest two cases.
Okay. Well, it's possible that the AODA play a role in it, whether Mr. Brouillet was aware of it or not, because the federal government's certainly aware of it and aware of the costs.
True.
Yeah. Is there any guesswork to be made productively about where these cuts are going? You said 500 jobs were in play, and how they might affect veterans' benefits or how veterans' benefits might be excluded from the cuts?
It's too early to say. What the department tells us is that their emphasis is on frontline services. So my expectation is that the occupational stress injury clinics and the personnel that actually work on the military bases delivering frontline services likely will not be affected. I mean, I think it's a darn shame that they're not actually dedicating more resources to that part of the operation,
right.
But I think it's safe to assume that anyone who's in an administrative or an IT or a support position has good reason to be concerned.
Yeah. Okay.
And as a result, I think that every single member of the veterans community has very good reason to be concerned. If not about the quantum of their benefits, certainly they have reason to be concerned about the level of service.
Yeah.
It
boils down to the same effect in the end.
True.
Yeah.
True. If they don't cut benefits but make them harder to get, haven't they really cut benefits?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I hope that's not what's being planned, to cut them by making them harder to get. This has been experienced by people on civilians on fixed incomes in Ontario for, oh, gosh, since 1995 now.
Yeah, I hope that's not the case.
Yeah, I hope not.
Yeah.
Okay. Was there something that you wanted to say that we haven't touched on? Because basically I've followed your insight into this pretty closely, I think, and I haven't given you as much play as you might like to discuss how you feel about the issue.
Well, the only other thing that I'd like to add that we haven't talked about is the employees who serve veterans they love their work. They mm-hmm. love their clientele.
Mm-hmm.
They're deeply committed to what they're doing. They're professional. They just need the tools. They need the resources. They need the support at the political level in order to be able to do a first-class job. And there's an awful lot of stress within the civil service right now because of all of the talk that's been circulating with respect to the cuts coming down the pipe and the changes. So it makes for a very, very difficult environment when your job is to deliver care to Canada's heroes and you're worried about whether there's going to be a pink slip in 10 days. I would really urge the government, in the interests of veterans and in the interests of those who serve them, be transparent and get it done.
Yeah.
You know, be transparent, get it done. And when I say get it done, I think it would be an error to cut. But if the cuts are going to be made, be upfront, tell the truth, and let us know what the real impacts are going to be. There's a lot of people, both among veterans and among employees, that are on pins and needles.
Do you have any idea when things will be clearer? When perhaps we could call you back for an explanation of what has happened when it does?
I would say in the spring with the introduction of the next budget. So I think we're 5 months away from any clarity, at least 5 months away.
You're thinking an April budget?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, I hope that's not true. That maybe some information will be leaked. I know the government won't look upon me favorably for wishing a leak, but it seems in the face of the lack of clarity, a leak is the only best hope that we have.
Yep.
I'm sure there are people who share your concerns.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and talk for my listener today in the afternoon.
Well, it's a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, too. You've been listening to Federal MP from Charlottetown and sole Liberal member of the Standing Committee on Veterans Affairs, as well as the Liberal Veterans Affairs critic, Sean Casey, talk about the conservative cuts to Veterans Affairs and the apparent refusal to divulge information on the impact on veterans and their benefits. Call 528-9888 and pledge, or go to the site, cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Use the PayPal link to contribute. See you next week. This is Disrespect Radio. I think you're here instead of listening to commercial radio because you want to. Well, something funny, I'm here because I want to, too. All our hosts on community radio are unpaid volunteers. Our management takes less than scale, so they must want to, too. Our guests, they have to want to as well. They're not looking for the big endorsement. They're not looking for big bucks. They're here because they want to talk to you, the CFMU listener. We're simulcast around the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're also podcast back 6 or 7 years at this time. We're archived at radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can reach the show at disrespect@lycos.com. Come back at showtime next week on CFMU 93.3 on your radio at 12 noon on Thursdays. You know you want to.